150 is a nice round number as numbers go. So, of course, Nevada is celebrating its sesquicentennial. That's the 150th anniversary of statehood. And one of the projects to mark the occasion is a big illustrated history titled Nevada, 150 Years in the Silver State. The book will be launched tomorrow night at the Clark County Library. We've got a link with details at knprnews.org. Also with us, we have Jeff Schumacher. Jeff Schumacher edited the big book, and he joins us now. Jeff, welcome back. Good to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
You wrote in the introduction, in the beginning, Nevada was an obstacle, not a destination.
Right.
Pretty stark sentence. What did you mean?
Well, because it was true. I think, when people started moving west, they wanted to get to California, right? So crossing Nevada, which was just this huge desert, limited water, long treks, mountains, it was a very difficult place to traverse. And so a lot of people didn't stop. If they got through at all, they were happy to have it in the rearview mirror.
Okay, so what got our state out of the situation of, you know, having the unofficial motto being something like Gateway to California?
Well, I think that would be gold and silver. I think that was
gold
the primary.
And silver.
Those are the primary motivations. People who had found silver and gold in the hills up near Virginia City and across the state really found that for those riches, they were willing to endure these harsh temperatures and dry landscapes.
Now, also joining us is Scott Dickensheets, who had a hand in editing the book and wrote some of the entries. Scott, the book's got numerous small articles on specific topics. How did you pick those topics?
Well, it was a matter of trying to decide what was important and how things were important. When you're covering a lot of not just history, you know, in the chronological sense, but you've got, you know, categorical things to cover. You've got your sports, you've got culture, you've got politics. So there was a lot of like breaking those subjects down into smaller constituent parts. There was a lot of crowdsourcing. I mean, a lot of asking people that I knew or that Jeff knew what was important and how it was important to approach those things. And one of the things I like best about the book is that it's so multifaceted. I mean, there's a lot of information about a lot of different things. Some of it, you know, people might not, you know, expect to see covered or whatever. So mm-hmm.
What was one of the most surprising things you found as you began to put this book together that people will also find surprising when they read it?
Just how many interesting and, you know, I think of before this project, history as sort of this monolithic thing in the background. And so the book really does a great job of giving you the sense of how many strands of things go into history. It's not this one sort of large looming thing that's, you know, in the background. So there's a lot of interesting characters and people and historical figures in the book.
Give us a taste of one who illustrates that point. Is there one particular that comes to mind? Jeff Schumacher, is there one particular figure who comes to mind? You know, when Scott's talking about just a taste of an interesting character.
Well, and I'm going to forget the names, but there's a great debate about who founded Reno, for example. And so I didn't know that was going to be the topic when I assigned the writer to give me a little history of early Reno. But he came back with a piece that really had that apparently historians have been battling over this for years as to who exactly should be credited as the founder of the city of Reno or the community of Reno.
Is it like a prospector?
It's actually who built the bridge over the river in order to get to Virginia City or to California.
Okay. You build the bridge and you get to name it, I guess. And that leads us to turn to Michael Green. Speaking of historians, he teaches U.S. history and Nevada history at the College of Southern Nevada. Okay, so you build the bridge and you get to name the town?
If you build it, they will come.
They will come.
And that was the idea. Who, you know, when you look at the history of Reno, you go back to Myron Lake. Okay, then you have, well, did Lake really do this? Did someone else do it? Do you really give Charles Crocker the credit because he's with the Central Pacific Railroad? Every place, every group has a creation story. Sometimes it's a myth and sometimes it isn't. And whatever civilization it is, we fight over it. I can speak to a previous experience. I wrote a seventh grade Nevada history textbook and said that the first settlement was Genoa. And the people of Dayton wanted to send out a party to kill me because they say, no, Dayton, Nevada was first. And so now I've written a textbook that's coming out next year, and I take the position that it's one of the two.
And that's, you're going to stand firm on that.
I feel very strongly.
Well, I'd ask this tidbit question a couple of moments ago, but you say there's a lot of myth built up around why Abraham Lincoln pushed for Nevada statehood. So what's the myth and what's the reality?
Well, the myth is that he wanted Nevada to be a state because he needed our gold and silver to fight the Civil War. Well, Nevada was a territory. If anything, he had more control over Nevada when it was a territory than he would when it was a state. So the myth grew about the gold and silver. The reality is that he had a couple of things going on in 1864. One was the desire to pass the 13th Amendment, which ultimately either he did or Daniel Day Lewis did, one of the two. One of the two did it. But he wanted votes in Congress, and he wanted votes from the individual states as part of the process. Nevada could be a vote in the House, and it was close enough that one vote might turn it, and the states, he needed three quarters. So that's been commonly held up as a reason for statehood. The other part of the story is that Lincoln was running for re-election, thought he might lose, and wanted every electoral vote that he could get. Well, he had calculated that he would have 117 electoral votes and his opponent would have 114. And then somebody, it's believed to be a guy in the telegraph office, added a 3 below Lincoln's numbers to make it 120. And by the way, Nevada did not give Lincoln its 3 electoral votes. The third elector got stuck in a blizzard and didn't make it to the vote. So Nevada only gave him 2, so Lincoln's majority was only 212 to 21.
Yeah, you didn't reckon with the campaign brilliance of George McClellan.
Yes, it doesn't hurt to have the right opponent.
Jeff Schumacher, there's a constant thread in Nevada history. The state's been dominated for all 150 years by one or two industries, first mining and railroads since the early 20th century, gambling. How has that dominance sequentially shaped Nevada history?
Well, I think if you look at the simple population of the state, you see that after gambling was legalized and tourism became the primary industry in the 20th century, then the population just went crazy. And it really brought Nevada into the modern age. You really can divide the state history into before and after when it comes to that. That's not to say that, a year after gambling was legalized, that Nevada was suddenly a modern place. But what it did is it kickstarted the growth of Nevada and the creation of a state that had some staying power. There was a lot of question, at the turn of the 20th century as to whether Nevada ought to remain a state. Mike actually has a great piece in the book about the 1880s and how this was like probably the worst decade in Nevada's history. And, people were just leaving. They're like, oh, we're done with Nevada. What a waste of time that place is. And ultimately, the state persevered and figured out what its reason for existence was and legalized gambling and, the rest is history.
Now, Scott Dickensheets, the book describes Southern Nevada as a late bloomer. And it surely is a late bloomer, but why so? What took so long for Las Vegas as far as just taking off and coming into its own is concerned?
Well, all the mining interests were generally situated north and central to here. The state government was located north, up in the north. And I think, for so long, Nevada was just Las Vegas was just, sort of a dusty railroad stop. All the gravity of government administration and mining-driven economy was up north.
To give you an idea of how northern-centric the state was for so long, Guy Rocha has written extensively, the state archivist has written extensively about the naming of the state. What were they going to name Nevada when it became a state? And Nevada was not the leading candidate. It was going to be called Washoe. That was one of the leading names. Well, Washoe is really Reno and Washoe County and that whole area.
So who is lobbying for Nevada?
Well, Guy writes about 5,000 or 6,000 words on this, and it's kind of very murky, actually, as to who was lobbying for what. But in the end, Sierra Nevada became Nevada, is my understanding, and they kind of settled on one word instead of two.
Okay, so we move into the 20th century. Las Vegas is taking off. 70% of people and even more of the wealth is really down here. And I'm wondering, Scott Dickensheets, do you think that that's going to mean that the next century or so is going to be very different from the last century and a half now that the wealth has sort of shifted to the south?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think that's inevitable. I mean, so much of the population lives here, and so much of the resources are consumed here. And, I mean, the government, I don't think, will move down here. I think that's sort of like enshrined in law, right, that it's in up north. So, and you hear periodic calls for either on one side to move the state capital down here, or on the other side fears that that's what somebody is planning. I don't think that'll ever happen. So there will always be, like, a reason for Northern Nevada to exist, I suppose. But, you know, and there's recreation, you know, sort of a recreation economy up there as well. But, you know, again, Las Vegas just exerts so much gravity in the state that I think it's there'll be a South-centric quality to the next century for sure.
Yeah. Jeff Schumacher.
Well, you know, one of the things that brought me to this job of editing this book was the fact that I grew up in rural Nevada. I went to college in Northern Nevada, and then I worked in Southern Nevada. So I had this sort of the trifecta of Nevada experiences, right? So I have to put in a word for the rest of Nevada. I think that the Reno-Sparks area is very vibrant, Reno-Sparks-Carson City. I think there's a lot going on there. People in Las Vegas aren't paying attention because they have enough stuff to pay attention to here. But at least when you're talking about that metropolitan area, they've got their own identity and their own place. And if you talk to people up there, they still kind of look down their nose at Las Vegas, right or wrong. Mm-hmm. Now, the rest of the state's a whole nother issue. I think you'll find that it's a really, really small percentage of the Nevada population that lives outside of the Reno Sparks and the greater Las Vegas area. And the future of those areas, I think, is in great question as to what they'll look like in this new century.
Mm-hmm. Michael Green.
Well, historically, if you go back to the beginning, you have the Virginia City Gold Hill area, the Comstock dominating Nevada in the late 19th century, including the 1880s when there was nothing to dominate. Then, at the turn of the century, the discoveries in Tonopah Goldfield make that area important. And the wealth then tended to go to Reno as Nevada moved toward a tourism economy. And it's, I'd say, in the 60s that Las Vegas pulls ahead of Reno in population. And so there's always been one quadrant of the state dominating. And I always have the feeling someday something's going to happen in Jarbidge and they'll take over. I have no clue what's going to happen.
White Pine County, the powerhouse of Nevada.
One never knows, does one? Now, Michael Green, I think it would also be fair to say that Las Vegas, in terms of its growth, had the help of a lot of figures, including some who were underworld figures. The mob had a lot to do with building the gambling industry here. How would you assess the impact of organized crime on Las Vegas? Did they really make it different, or was it just a source of investment capital and money laundering for these folks and then for the casinos?
Well, the answer is yes. I mean, it is both. They make an important contribution, and Las Vegas is making an important contribution to international, and let's not limit it to the borders of the United States, international organized crime, because this is a place to launder money. This is a place where they can legally do what was illegal elsewhere. And I always like to cite the Benny Binion story, where Benny arrives from Dallas and they say, "Why'd you leave Dallas?" And he said, "My sheriff got beat." Well, yeah, you had your guy in your hip pocket, and if he was defeated, you had to leave. There was another boss who was going to take over. And so this area's appealing for them. It provides this opportunity. And they bring in capital that leads to the building of the Strip. But then in turn, we're never going to know, I suppose, how much money left Las Vegas. And to be fair, Reno, Lake Tahoe, there's mob activity up there too. How much is leaving there and going into other coffers?
Now, Jeff Schumacher, speaking of organized crime and such, the article on Oscar Goodman views his election as Las Vegas mayor as a real sign of changed attitudes about the history of the mob here. Why so?
Well, you know, I think that's true. I mean, if you think about it, looking at Las Vegas from the outside, and we elect as our mayor a former mob defense attorney, a very prominent one who had defended some of the worst guys that we've ever seen in the country, they probably wouldn't be doing that in Ames, Iowa. They just wouldn't elect that guy. Even here, that was surprising, I think, because as much as people will say, well, I liked Las Vegas better when the mob ran it, a lot of times you don't really feel that way when you know what they were doing and you know what they were capable of. And so the idea of actually electing someone like that as the mayor was surprising. But I think what it did is it reflected the fact that they understood what Goodman was actually doing. He wasn't in the mob. I mean, he was defending them on their constitutional rights. And I think once that was sort of, once people got that through their head, they felt a little better about it.
Scott Dickensheets.
I also think that his brashness about it and his unrepentance about that also speaks to this sort of tang of mob glamour that I think threads throughout the modern history of Vegas and adds to some way to its allure for a lot of people.
Yeah, Michael Green, give you the last word on Oscar.
Well, there'll never be the last word on Oscar.
Touche.
But first of all, he was a very good politician. You want a mayor who's getting attention, who's surrounded by showgirls or whatever. And it also appeals to what Jeff was also saying, and Scott alluded to, this sort of nostalgia for something that wasn't, this ideal that the mob was wonderful and really ran the town, and now we're going to go back to the good old days, even if we know we're really not.
Jeff Schumacher edited Nevada, 150 Years in the Silver State. It's the sesquicentennial history. Michael Green of the College of Southern Nevada and Scott Dickensheets of Desert Companion magazine also contributed to the book. They will all help to launch it tomorrow night at the Clark County Library, and we've got details at knprnews.org. Gents, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.